As of this moment, the report of the President's Commission is public record.
15 seconds after the Warren Commission report went public, CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite summed it up.
Who killed John F. Kennedy? The Commission answers unequivocally, Lee Harvey Oswald. Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy?
In the 1970s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations confirmed Oswald's involvement, but left the door open for the possibility of another gunman.
Secret Service men all around.
The conspiracy theory has been kept alive by other revelations over the years, like a reported plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas. But few things fueled Americans' belief in a conspiracy more than this.
Once you conclude, the magic bullet could not create all seven of those wounds?
In his 1991 film, JFK, director Oliver Stone made what might be the best-known case against the Warren Commission report.
And by definition, there had to be a conspiracy.
22 years later, Stone is still convinced he's right.
Governments lie. And everything we've learned since 1991 when the film came out has reinforced the notion that the governments have not been straight with us.
The car that carried Vice President Lyndon Johnson through the streets of Dallas was one of a million reminders that he, who had once been among the most powerful men in the country, was now, in his own opinion, a nobody. Washed up. The car was a Lincoln like the president's, but Johnson's Lincoln was a rental.
And it didn't get any better as he looked up the road and all he could see were the throngs that had turned out. Bigger crowds than anyone had expected, but crowds that were turning out to see John F. Kennedy. Johnson's political rival, the man he believes had taken away not just the nomination for the presidency in 1960, but perhaps his last best chance ever to become the president of the United States.
I want to first talk about the mastermind, Lyndon Baines Johnson. There were three scandals that were operating in 1963, and Johnson was in hot water. These were part of his prior psychopathic behavior, the Bobby Baker scandal, the Billy Saul Estes scandal, and the Fred Horth scandal. They were considering investigating Lyndon Johnson's ethical behavior. Bobby Kennedy wanted to get him off the ticket for 1964. He was in deep trouble. He did not like JFK, and he particularly did not like Robert Kennedy. During the Billy Saul Estes case, Billy Saul Estes was arrested and charged with fraud, and Johnson's fingerprints were on it. And Bobby Kennedy said, if you implicate Johnson, he'll get him out of prison. He was the attorney general. He could have done that. Billy Saul Estes said, if I did that, I'd be dead in 24 hours. Lyndon Johnson was not someone to mess with.
When Bobby Kennedy finds out that Johnson will be on the ticket with his brother, he's horrified, and he tries to stop it. Johnson knows this, and their mutual hatred becomes the enduring blood feud of their lives.
Bobby Kennedy embodied everything that Johnson was not and Johnson despised. He was rich. He was good-looking. He was full of intellectual fervor.
Kennedy wins the White House in one of the narrowest elections in history, and almost two-thirds of his winning margin comes from Lyndon Johnson's Texas. But the vice presidency is a miserable experience. Johnson quickly learns that he has no power except what the president gives him, and that is almost nothing. Worse, he is a thing of ridicule in Kennedy's glamorous and sophisticated Washington.
He had a mistress. Her name was Madeline Brown. The night before the assassination, he was in a secret meeting, and he stormed out of that meeting, and this is what she said.
Let's go back to that before. When Johnson came out of the meeting, what did he say to you?
He was so angry. He had a violent temper when he was upset.
Well, let's use the exact words that he said to you. What did he say to you?
He grabbed me by the arm, and he had this deep voice, and he said, after tomorrow, those SOBs will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. And it startled me, really, you know, because he was so ruddy-faced. I thought, oh, well, he really, something went on that shouldn't have gone on. And there were violence feelings that have never been told that was between those two people.
There's a bar owner named Oresta Pena in New Orleans. Okay. After the assassination, he testifies in front of the House Select Assassinations Committee in the 1970s, and he says that he saw Oswald meeting with an FBI agent named Warren DeBries. That's a very old, recent picture of DeBries. You got to imagine him 50 years younger, because he didn't look like that in 1963. I couldn't find a younger picture of him. So he said, Oswald was meeting with this DeBries a lot. They knew each other well. And DeBries threatened me, he said, I didn't want me to testify. And when Oswald moved from New Orleans to Dallas, DeBries followed him to Dallas. So believe me, that he was either an FBI informant, he was doing something with the FBI. Now, he talked like a barroom owner, Oresta Pena. Now, the HSCA, the committee that investigated, also took testimony from the FBI and DeBries. I never knew Oswald, never had any connection with Oswald, never threatened Mr. Pena, and I never went to Dallas until after the assassination. I was asked to go to Dallas after Kennedy was shot because they needed extra FBI people in Dallas. That's what they said. The committee believed him, did not believe Pena. End of story. Bye-bye. But then Trump releases a document that is going to knock your socks off. This is the document released in November. It is requested that this case be reassigned, inasmuch as the agent to whom this case is assigned at present will be absent from the New Orleans office on special assignment at Dallas for an indefinite period. Well, Warren DeBries is going to Dallas, okay? But look at the date of this memo. It's October 25th. It's a month before Kennedy is shot. He is going to Dallas right after Oswald goes to Dallas. And he's not going to Dallas after the assassination. There were plans to send him to Dallas a month before the assassination. Question is, why did Oswald need to be killed? Why was this effort being made, and then it fell to Jack Ruby to do that? Well, let's take a look at the reasons. First, Oswald actually liked President Kennedy. He said, nothing irritated me about President John Kennedy and a nice family. Secondly, he said he'd never been to Mexico except to Tijuana. Now, wait a minute. We can't have him testifying in court that he wasn't in Mexico City banging on the desks of the Cuban consulate and the Soviet embassy. That would not look good in court. Oswald was, after all, meeting with an FBI agent, DeBries, and had meetings with David Phillips. And having that come out in a trial would certainly be devastating to the government's case or to LBJ's case. Fourthly, Oswald actually had cooled on Marxism. He said, the way you're treating me, I may as well be in Russia. That's not a nice thing for a Marxist, Leninist, socialist assassin to be saying. And then they asked him, would you like to hide your face, as they were taking him from place to place. He said, why should I hide my face? I haven't done anything to be ashamed of.
There is Leon. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun.
So Jack Ruby is tasked with the assignment. And shortly before Ruby's death, he died 3 years after this from a strange cancer. He admitted to his jailer that his job was to silence Oswald. And he did his job. Of course, the Warren Commission said he was just the nightclub owner and that he shot Oswald so that Jackie Kennedy wouldn't have to come to Dallas to testify in court. And that sort of made it through all of the mainstream media. But what didn't make it through the mainstream media was that Jack Ruby was mafia all the way. He was a courier for Al Capone. He knew Al Capone. He had 9 prior arrests. He had made a whole bunch of long-distance calls to some of the biggest mafia figures in the 2 months before the assassination. His first visitor in prison was a mafiosi named Joseph Campisi. So Mafia's, Ruby's Mafia record is amazing. But here's a document I come across in Trump's document release. They're kind of grainy, but take a look. An FBI informant is hanging out with Ruby. This has been withheld for 54 years. The informant stated that on the morning of the assassination, 3 hours before Kennedy was killed, Ruby contacted him and asked if he would like to watch the fireworks.
Just about the time that Johnson's car is going past the Texas Book Depository, the first shot rings out. No one knows exactly what it is yet, but the Secret Service agent sitting in the front of the car, Rufus Youngblood, yells out, "Get down, get down." Then he grabs Johnson by the shoulder like this and pulls him down onto the floor of the car. Remember, there are three people back here, so it's really, really tight. But Johnson isn't moving, even though he's got a heavy Secret Service agent on his back. He is very calm, lying on the floor, listening to the sound of the police radio talk about what's going on up ahead. And he hears, he's been hit, he's been hit. That's about the president.
But apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
So while it was indeed a tragic day, it was precisely for a day like this that Johnson decided to seek the vice presidency in the first place.
And this is the most revealing wink of the 20th century. He turns to Albert Thomas. Albert Thomas winks at LBJ. Job well done. Well, that photograph has been excised from the photographic library in the Johnson Library. So this is the whole picture, or pretty much the whole picture. LBJ on top, CIA next, William Harvey, critical person, dealing with Russelli, who connects them to the Chicago, to the Mafia, okay? And the Mafia gives us three assassins, Nicoletti, Files, and King.
Constitutionally, he's automatically the president, but Johnson wants to be sworn in before the plane leaves for Washington. He arranges this photo, making sure Jackie Kennedy is there as a signal of continuity. Back in Washington, continuity becomes the priority. The congressmen and reporters who'd been investigating Johnson for corruption drop it out of fear of losing another president in a crisis. Johnson invites all of Kennedy's cabinet to stay in their jobs, including Bobby Kennedy. And why not? They were highly competent, the best and the brightest, it was said. But he also enjoyed that the tables had turned on his tormentors.
Everything is cellularized. No one has said he must die. There's been no vote, nothing's on paper. There's no one to blame. It's as old as the crucifixion. A military firing squad. Five bullets, one blank, no one's guilty. Because everyone in the power structure who knows anything has a plausible deniability. There are no compromising connections except at the most secret point. Paramount is that it must succeed. No matter how many die, no matter how much it costs, the perpetrators must be on the winning side and never subject to prosecution for anything by anyone.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.